Thank you, Robin, for that introduction. I'm not quite sure that if I got those accolades when I was back in school for my writing skills, but I guess that was punishment for my often distinctive turn of phrase. You might notice that the imported Italian water bottles are now absent from the front desk up here. I think it's the height of madness, particularly from a greenhouse gas perspective, that we drink imported bottled water from Italy and France. And I just read recently that if they could get the French if you could convince the French to reduce their consumption of bottled water by about 50%, there would be 700 trucks taken off the road every day in France, both delivering bottled water and taking away the plastic bottles. But anyway, that's a bit of an aside. After the very stimulating first session, which was really about the Murray-Darling Basin and about irrigation water, I'm thinking to myself, how fortunate and how blessed I am to work in the urban water industry, because we can look forward to a very optimistic future. We've got a great track record in reform and adapting to the changes, and that goes right back to the 1994 COAG agreement, where, with the exception of externality pricing, all of those milestones were met by the urban water industry, and that's left us in good shape to implement the changes in the industry that are really required to meet the significant challenges that climate change is really imposing on us. Just as a couple of ironies, I guess, that quite often in the urban water sector, you hear the pricing mentioned as being a lever and one of the market mechanisms to influence outcomes. You rarely ever hear the P word being used in rural water. I think Mike Young might have mentioned it once, but I don't understand why pricing can't be used more often then, but then I'm an urban boy, so what would I know? And the second thing is, I'm just wondering whether I can use the logic of leakage that's used in the urban sector, in the irrigation sector, and apply that in the urban sector, where we get berated when we've got leakage rates, you know, of less than, you know, 1 or 2%, whereas it seems to be looked upon as being in a different light in the irrigation sector. But the reason I'm very confident is that there's a revolution going on in urban water. We woke up 5 years ago that there'd been a fundamental shift, and we decided that we needed to diversify our sources of water so we were no longer dependent on river dam water, because as you've already seen, runoff is the first casualty of climate change. We're in the midst of an investment boom where there's somewhere around $30 billion being invested in new water infrastructure right across Australia. So just moving on to the state of play across Australia, really Perth, Adelaide and Melbourne are the only capital cities that really haven't done well out of the summer rainfall. Both Sydney, Canberra and, of course, Brisbane have increased their storage levels from where they were this time last year. And I think that all of the predictions of it getting wetter up the top and drier in the south are certainly proving to be correct. But I think the Minister and Ken have also mentioned that water is a front-of-mind issue. These are just some of the headlines that were in the papers, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Fin Review, and I think the Australian last week. But it's interesting, last week in Sydney, IPART introduced its interim, or announced its interim pricing agreement, which puts water prices up by about 16 or 17%, plus inflation, plus CPI for the first year, and then it goes down to something like, you know, 5 or 6% plus CPI for the next 4 years. You know, there was a bit of coverage on the first day about tap torture there, you can see. I think there was about 2 or 3 letters to the editor the following day. Second day, zip. Third day, zip. Alan Jones, the parrot, didn't cover it. And so the urban community is well adjusted to the fact that water prices have to rise, and water prices will rise, because unlike the irrigation sector, there's no free lunch for the urban water community. The infrastructure being put in place now to harden our water supply systems to cope with climate change will be paid for by the urban water industry, being the urban water consumer, and that is good public policy, and we should never ever forget that, and we should never apologise for the fact that on top of paying for that infrastructure, we're also paying our shareholders dividends, which is also good public policy. But I'll just quickly go through the context, because there's a few other interesting things I want to talk about, but these are the things that are really driving what's happening in the urban water industry. Yields are collapsing. You don't need to be told that. We've got rapidly growing populations. You know, urban Australia is going to have to deal with an additional 8 to 10 million people by 2050, and the demographics is changing, particularly in relation to household types. The most rapidly growing household type in Australia is a single-person household. And, of course, with single-person households, you lose your economies of scale in water use. We live in a growing a society that's becoming more affluent. What our parents and our grandparents put up with, people won't put up with now. So there's an expectation that if you can afford the McMansion and the BMW in the driveway, well, surely we can afford to have water to put on our lawns and on our garden. Of course, everyone knows that our rivers are crying out for water and help, and we accept those accountabilities in the urban water industry. And, of course, the sustainability issue is really the threshold issue for this century, that if we had green, non-polluting sources of energy, we could do anything with water. We could pump it, we could treat it, we could even, you know, maybe connect up to the Kimberley, because, you know, we would have all of these options. But of course we don't. And you can see, if there's one thing is true, that the new sources of water, such as recycled water and desalination and even groundwater, are much more energy intensive than what the traditional source of water is, of having a couple of dams up on the hill and using the gravity to convey it to the customers. And of course there is a strong interdependency between between energy use and water use, right from the power station right down to heating the hot water to have a shower. We're often criticised for being a little bit slow off the mark in sort of hardening our systems in the cities to climate change. I would argue that it's just in time asset delivery rather than sort of trying to predict, because I'm sure that if we'd have pushed the augmentation button earlier and we got a biblical event, we would have been accused of what we've been accused for about the last 30 or 40 years, and that's over-investing and engineers using the water industry to fill their fantasies about actually building assets. So my vision for the urban water industry is that harsh long-duration water restrictions shouldn't be the way of the future. I mean, there's this view out there that it's good for, you know, that we deserve our penance in the cities, and that penance should involve in some, you know, self-inflicted hardship. It's almost like going up into a mountain in freezing cold weather and only a t-shirt and thongs, because it's good for the soul. And some people are telling us it's good for our soul that we've got to put ourselves to great inconvenience with water restrictions. Having said that, there are some caveats on it, that there will always be exceptional circumstances in Australia because we have the most variable rainfall of all the continents on the planet. Just bear in mind, London only stores 3 months of water for that city. Sydney and Melbourne store about 8 or 9 years of water. There's always going to be small run-of-the-river schemes and other systems which aren't up to it, and, of course, there's always going to be emergency. So to say there'll never be restrictions, you can never say never, because that would only lead to gold plating. But the principles, I'm going to go for this very quickly, that would deliver the vision, will be that no option on both the demand and supply side should be ruled out, and Ken Matthews is a great exponent of that particular principle, and I've heard him say it countless times. We've got to remove the artificial distinctions that currently exist between the rural and the urban systems. In this century, we should be looking at the water resource in totality and not putting up these arbitrary boundaries and saying that, you know, that's rural and that's urban and never the twain shall meet. We should be looking for water outcomes that deliver the best economic benefits and, you know, for the growth of this nation. Protection of river health, of course, I've mentioned that before. Prudent water-saving rules will always be part of it. Australia's led the world in water conservation programs, but I think, you know, the days of sort of, watering lawns and things like that in the middle of the day are well and truly over, and we would support those. And, of course, innovative water conservation programs are going to be needed because the low-hanging fruit has well and truly been harvested. And, of course, price water to reflect the costs, including the externalities, and I think that that should apply right across the board. And I think that governments in irrigation shouldn't set, pick winners in crops. But we've heard about the virtues of the markets have been extolled this morning numerous times. Let's let it rip with a bit of price reform in the rural area. Problem with restrictions? Well, they're blunt. You know, they certainly have a big impact on the urban amenity, particularly in cities like Adelaide and Melbourne, which are really reliant on their parks and open space. Gardens are popular in recreational pursuit. Sports fields have a special social role, particularly in rural Australia. They create perverse investment in very expensive local solutions, and they're highly inconvenient. And I should say that they only really target in external use at this stage. Okay, some matters for the future. I think that product differentiation will probably come in the water industry, urban water industry, sooner than what we think. I often think it's strange. We pull up to a petrol station these days and there's three kinds of unleaded fuel you can get, right from the vanilla brand right up to the premium, you know, sort of rocket fuel you put in your Italian sports car. Yeah, when it comes to water, we just deliver the vanilla product, and I think there's a great opportunity for people to actually come in, purchase water on the markets and say, for a certain price, we will allow you to use that water for watering your gardens and you don't need to worry about restrictions. But there is an egalitarian thing about bloody water that I haven't been able to work out, because we allow sort of people to differentiate themselves when it comes to their house or their motor car or the size of their plasma screen. But when it comes to water, you know, there's this great socialist sort of paradigm that prevails that everyone shall be equal. When volumes of recycled water are in decline, wastewater flows into wastewater treatment plants have plummeted by about 35% in some capital cities for a range of reasons. Groundwater's dropping, water efficient appliances, grey water recycling and the like. So it's difficult to bank recycled water volumes now. The era of the big systems, I think, are over, and this is particularly driven by new technology and also recycling. There's absolutely fantastic opportunities for the urban water industry in a carbon-constrained world. We've got great potential to generate significant greenhouse-friendly energy from our wastewater systems in particular, but also our water systems through hydroelectricity. And my vision here is that in 25 or 30 years, our wastewater treatment plants will be known for their ability to produce energy, and a positive externality of that energy production will be the treatment of the effluent. And we might be connecting trade waste people in and begging them to put their waste into our system, because we've already got the infrastructure there if we can turn it into energy. Water quality is becoming more complex with multiple sources. Smart meters are going to open up many opportunities. There's no doubt the private sector is going to be involved, and because of the technology, and also every time water prices go up, becomes more attractive. And I go back to my point, and I hate to sound boring about this, but if all of this is not done sustainably, there is no way known we will survive the court of public opinion. And just finally, be prepared to manage more complex systems in a more complex environment. I actually like the complexity of water, and that's why I like the politics of water, because, you know, water is the quintessential political commodity, and never forget that. Water resource planning, there is some science in it, but it's mostly art, and once again it's the art side that attracts me and many others to it, because it was all a matter of just plugging the numbers into an Excel spreadsheet where you give it to a couple of propeller heads and you could all go back and relax on the beach. And of course, because of the political and social nature of water, community and stakeholder consultation must be thorough, and you've got to bring the community along with you, because there's certainly, people don't get passionate about their gas molecules or their electrons that run their TV, but they sure do about water, which is really my final point about water, and it's probably embodied in what the first three speakers were saying here this morning, but expressed differently, that for some unknown reason, water is different. Why was it that the previous government was able to privatise Telstra and a range of other things, but they blink when it came to water? And water is different, and I think that water has a spiritual value and a spiritual aspect to it that many of the other everyday things we take for granted don't. And that's the great attraction of being in the water industry, dealing with such a topical and special commodity. So just in conclusion, I think the urban water industry is in great shape. We're not perfect. There's lots of things we can do, and we are doing those. And I think that we can look forward with great confidence to actually fixing our systems so they are ready and flexible. And let me tell you, it won't take us to 2019 to do it, because by 2019, climate change will have robbed you of all your other opportunities, and you'll be forced by Mother Nature to do the things much earlier than what's in those timetables. Thank you very much, Robin.